Chapter 5, The Fifth Principle, Connection Strengthens Relationship. Any obstacle in your child's way of success is your opportunity for connection. Connection happens easily when things are going well, when we're having fun. But what do you do when a problem arises for either you or your child? Forget about it and hope for the best? Try to fix it? Or connect with your child and strengthen your relationship? Through connection, we gain direct access to the root of any problem, any obstacle our child may be facing. When we are connected, we can ask for cooperation when we're having a problem. It is our means of establishing mutually open communication. Connection always bridges the gap. The gap. When communication shuts down and parental influence is blocked, a gap is created. Over time, it broadens and deepens until communication becomes almost impossible between a parent and a teenager. As soon as young children are seen as manipulative, parents begin to distrust and control. Punishments are enforced by the time a child is barely able to walk. Toilet training turns into an ongoing battle. Toddlers are reprimanded for their impulsive behavior, and daily life becomes a struggle. Every crying episode is seen as a meltdown, and temper tantrums are viewed as manipulative. Children are misunderstood. Is it any wonder they become confused, frustrated, and resistant? The gap is the space created between parent and child when the parent's intention is lost in anger, distrust, or fear, and the message the child receives is completely different from what the parent intended. Stress, confusion, fear, and misunderstandings fill the gap. When gaps are common, children become parent deaf in self-defense. Authority and positive influence are lost. Maria thought she'd left her boys watching Saturday morning cartoons while she was doing laundry. But as she came up the basement stairs, she heard shrieks coming from the living room. Couch pillows had been thrown around the room, furniture was out of place, a chair was on its side, and the boys were slugging each other with throw pillows. Jason, 8, was on the floor while 10-year-old Matthew straddled him, ready to strike. "What on earth are you doing?" Maria screamed. "Stop at this instant, do you hear me?" Laughter erupted from the boys. Maria assumed they were laughing at her. "How dare you destroy my living room? Stop all this noise and get to your rooms now." Matthew collapsed on the floor, saying, "Mom, chill." Incensed and feeling disrespected, Maria grabbed Matthew's arm and pulled him up. "There will be no bike ride this afternoon. Do you understand me? Now get to your room until I tell you to come down." Matthew stomped up the stairs and slammed his door, shouting that his mother was stupid, while Jason slunk out of the room and out of his mother's range. Both boys felt angry and unfairly treated, but expressed their feelings quite differently. Situations like this are common in most households. Nothing horrible, nothing abusive. Control takes over when parents fear their children will never learn to take responsibility, never listen, and behave disrespectfully. Forever. When children turn parent deaf, the screaming gets louder, the threats get emptier, and children learn that they can keep doing whatever they're doing until the parent reaches the latest breaking point. The gap widens. Learning to make connection. If we want our children to listen to us, we need to say what they can hear. Not give them what they want, simply acknowledge and respect what they want. Not ask them to solve our problems or take responsibility for our feelings, but see both sides. We need to learn how to say what our children will listen to before expecting cooperation and peace. Connection does not mean hugs and kisses and happiness abound. Connection can occur through conflict. It is a way of communicating that encourages listening and talking and feeling important to someone. Interaction. Disconnection occurs when we are indifferent as well as critical, blaming, and punitive. Studies show that children who get in trouble either at home or at school are the ones who feel disconnected. When disconnection happens, more trouble follows. When people feel disconnected from the family, community, or world at large, they have no reason to respect their rules. They have disdain for authority and often engage in misconduct. Connection, on the other hand, is a preventive measure against risky, rebellious, and defiant behaviors. Who owns the problem? Begin by looking at whose problem it is. From the objectivity of our meeting room, it was understood that the pillow-throwing incident was Maria's problem. So were her assumptions that the boys were being rude and never took her seriously. The boys were having fun. They didn't care that couch pillows were being thrown and the room was a mess. Pillows felt better than fists, and they weren't fighting. Their mother's anger seemed unjustified to them. In order to connect, Maria would first need to own her problem and acknowledge how she felt without making them responsible for her feelings. Instead, she dumped her problem on them and punished them to teach them never to make a problem for her again. In the heat of the moment, it's hard to see this, but the boys sensed unfairness and reacted, each in his own way. Maria has just as much right to her anger as her children have to theirs, as long as she owns it. If Maria yells, "What happened? The living room is a wreck. I can't stand it," she is owning her problem. Children's radar is strong and senses the unfairness when we make them responsible for our problems. When children don't feel unjustly accused, they're more likely to cooperate with what we need. The following are examples of expressing feelings but owning the problem. "I will not allow anyone to hit me, and you must never allow anyone to hit you. You're very angry with me. Tell me what it is you want to say." "I'm having a hard time concentrating. I know you just want to have fun. I need some quiet." "I hate feeling ignored. What do you need to be able to hear me?" See your child's point of view. Step into your children's shoes and listen to what you sound like. Then ask yourself, "How would I like hearing what I just said?" Connection requires empathy. Being able to see the situation from your child's viewpoint and hear what you sound like to your child. You will never understand completely, but your effort is what keeps you connected and respectful. Consider agendas. Maria's kids were having fun. Their agenda was to build forts with furniture and have a pillow fight. Maybe even stay out of the way, since bike rides had been promised if their parents' chores were completed early. Maria's agenda was to get the laundry done, clean the kitchen, and make her phone calls before bike riding. She requested cooperation. Now the living room was a wreck. Frustrating? Absolutely. Cause for anger and punishment? Probably not, especially if she didn't take on their problem of cleaning up the living room. If she had told them that the room had to be clean and orderly before anyone could go for a bike ride, she would have held them accountable for their behavior. No blame, no reactive defense, and no punishment. But when she saw another big job added to her list, she blew up. Say what your children can hear. When we yell a lot of negatives, "Stop it! Don't! Why can't you ever? If you do that once more," the focus is on what's wrong. Children hear blame. Who wants to listen to that? Why do we think we have the right to talk to our children differently than how we expect them to talk to us? The deeper into the gap you are, the more negative your words sound. The closer to connection you are, the more positive or objective your words, much easier to respond to. A well-intentioned lesson can be interpreted by your child across the gap as a threat, a demand, put-down, or accusation. Through connection, that same lesson can be heard and understood. Phrases like, "You never listen," or "I'm so disappointed in you," "You're so mean," or "You're going to be the death of me," can lead to serious self-esteem issues on the other side of the gap. Using connective communication. Connective communication is the most important skill in parenting, as it includes so many of the principles set forth here. It's perfectly simple, makes total sense, works, and is one of the hardest skills for most parents to accomplish. Why? Because we don't see how important it is to be as respectful of our children as we want them to be of us. And because we fear that allowing negative feelings will lead to inappropriate behavior. And because we don't understand that the release of emotions is the best prevention of misbehavior. And because it doesn't come naturally. We were not spoken to this way. For most parents, learning connective communication is equivalent to learning a foreign language. It initially feels awkward and wrong. We think it indulges and condones the behavior we don't want. When it is not heartfelt, connective communication can sound patronizing to children and they reject it. When it's genuine, it can change relationships. Connective communication is respectful, trusting, empathic, and validating. It lets children know their feelings are normal. It's inquisitive without being interrogating. It allows feelings to vent and it gets to the root. The steps of connective communication. When your child has a problem or is behaving inappropriately, number one, stop what you're doing and give your child your full attention. Do not attempt this when your emotions have escalated. You can always come back to the situation later. Sometimes it's helpful to make eye contact, and sometimes it's better not to. Number two, disengage. Stop inappropriate behavior, but do not react to, judge, or criticize the behavior. Then put the behavior aside temporarily and go for the root. Three, name the problem without criticism or blame so your child can hear you. You boys are having a hard time. You really wish I would say something different. I really don't like it when clothes are left all over the floor. The television needs to be turned off. Number four, do not try to fix the problem or rescue your child from it. Take all problems seriously. Never deny or belittle your child's feelings with, "Why are you crying about a thing like that?" Don't start telling your child what she should do or say. Number five, empathize with your child's emotion. Validate and reflect back what you hear, see, or guess is going on. Giving words to emotions lets your child know she's normal. Remember, feelings are always okay. Boys are more likely to open up when active, shooting baskets, playing catch. Some examples. I totally understand how angry you must have felt. I wonder if you were feeling left out. You must have felt really confused by what your teacher asked. I guess you were really angry at your sister to have hit her. Don't worry about putting words in your child's mouth. If you're wrong, your child will be happy to tell you so. Mean what you say. If your words don't sound sincere, your child will shut down. Number six, no questions, yet. Think of a period at the end of your sentence. Without a question, your child is free to listen and doesn't have to answer. Questions put him on the spot and may feel interrogating. You're giving the problem your best guess. Your child will either take it in silently, agree, or disagree. The following are good sentence beginnings to keep you from questioning. You must have felt, "I bet if I were you, I wonder if, I'm guessing that you must, I can hear that you, it sounds to me like, I know just what you mean. I feel the same way when," number seven, no buts. Putting a but after your empathizing statement wipes out your intention. "I can understand how angry you must feel, but you know you can't hit," tells your child you care more about the hitting than his feelings. He's back to feeling blamed. Number eight, rechannel emotions and energy into acceptable behavior. Give your child pillows to hit, Play-Doh or clay to squish, or paper to rip. Time him when he runs from the fence to the garage or up and down the stairs. Give her a punching bag or a trampoline. Allow one couch, bed, or mattress for jumping on or kicking. Bonus points. Share a story of your own, illustrating that you have felt the same way. "I hate getting up in the morning, too. It's my least favorite part of the day." Or make up a story about another child going through a similar situation. "Once there was a little girl whose mother went away on a trip, and she felt very, very sad." Allow in fantasy what can't be in reality. If you could say anything you wanted to her and no one would tell you not to, what would you say? Imagine everything in this kitchen was made of ice cream. What flavor would the refrigerator be? Which would you eat first? Pretend you could push a button and wings would fly out from your bed. Where would you like it to take you? Pretend you had a magic wand and could turn you or me or your sister into whatever you wanted. What would it be? For the pre-verbal child, simply state what happened. It's comforting to a young child who has lost control to hear you put her experience in words and normalize the situation after the crying begins to subside. "You wanted the blue plate and I gave you the red one. You had a picture in your mind of your sandwich on that blue plate, and when you couldn't have it that way, you felt sad and mad at me for not giving you the blue one." The problem with questions. As we will soon see, questions are very important when you help your child to problem solve. But if you want your child to open up and expose the root of the behavior, stay away from questions. If a parent asks, "Why did you do that?" or "What are you so mad about?" the child feels set up, pressured. He wonders, do I answer what Dad wants to hear or what he doesn't want to hear? What if his honest answer is, because I hate her and wish she were dead? Will he get in trouble? Would his father understand that he doesn't really mean it, he just needs to blow off steam? I don't know, is his safe exit from the hot seat. But if a parent offers, I bet you wish your sister wasn't around sometimes, he will feel safer to release angry tension. Questions often carry blame, so a defensive answer, maybe a lie, is sure to follow. A mother asked her son, who had started lying to her, why do you lie to me all the time? His answer was, if you don't want me to lie, stop asking me questions. Many children also fear disappointing a parent with a truthful answer. Statements don't require answers. The child doesn't even have to respond, but he can take it in. He may need time to process his thoughts. Being your child's ally. Perhaps the strongest argument for connective communication is that it helps children make sense of difficult situations. From abuse to death or loss to violent behavior to simple misunderstandings, if the problem is never expressed, it can harm a child's emotional development forever. Your child needs you to be her ally. If not you, she may try to find someone else. When she knows you will listen and not judge or criticize her, she will trust you and know she can turn to you no matter what. Even a child's inexcusable behavior can be talked about and resolved once the feelings that provoked it are acknowledged and validated. Then the problem can be put in proper perspective. Even feelings of terror and abandonment can be normalized so the child can feel balanced again. Learning connective communication gives you the tools to provide this process for your children. The child who doesn't talk about it. If your child is an introvert, he's likely to process his feelings internally instead of talking things out like the extrovert. Don't worry, he's figuring things out before he commits to his words. One of the beauties of connective communication is that by using statements to connect, you're not expecting a verbal response. If you can put the situation into validating words, even your introvert can hear the empathy, not feel blamed, and put the pieces together internally. When you give words to possible emotions, you're modeling for your nonverbal or preverbal child, and the connection is still happening. Being your child's sounding board. Sometimes we don't need to say much, but simply provide a sounding board so our children can get it out, hear themselves, and allow the deeper roots to emerge. Some children are so sensitive to being patronized or are suspicious about what we're after that we need to simply be that sounding board before attempting connective communication. Detaching from the situation enough to avert reaction and allow your child to rant, no matter how annoying it gets, can open doors to those roots. When children are given the opportunity to talk things out to a neutral person, they can often find the direction to take to solve their own problems. Sometimes all they need to do is express their feelings to be done with the problem. It's the rare but artful parent who can detach enough to allow this to happen. Steps to becoming a sounding board. 1. Detach. Temporarily ignore the words or behavior. Imagine the behavior sailing over your head rather than slamming into you. 2. Don't try to fix the problem or teach a lesson. Remind yourself that your child is having a problem. It's not about you. 3. Look to the root. Understand that there is an emotional cause beneath the behavior that needs to emerge. 4. Listen. Take your child seriously and listen to what is being said without judgment, criticism, blame, or reaction. Take dramatic words with a grain of salt. 5. Deflect. Let the words bounce back to your child so she can hear herself. 6. Trust. Encourage your child's ability to solve her own problem. She may need your help, but trust her lead. One Saturday morning, as Eleanor was cleaning, she reminded her three boys to shower, eat breakfast, and get dressed before playing so they would be ready when their friends arrived. As usual, she reminded them three times before anyone seemed to hear her. On the fourth go-round, the oldest and youngest followed her request, but Nick, her middle son at age 6, went ballistic. He started screaming at his mother. You liar! You lie! You never said we had to take showers! You're lying! Leaving his words alone, Eleanor explained reasonably that she had asked them to take showers, silently wondering if she had left that step out on the one reminder that he actually heard. She said, "Nick, if you want to play, you need to do those things first." Now, in his bedroom, Nick continued his liar rant. But suddenly, midstream, his tone changed, and Eleanor heard, "You never play with me, and all you care about is the house being clean, and I don't care about that." The root had emerged. "You're a liar" was childology for "you're always too busy." She immediately went to Nick and said, "Oh, so you're upset because you want to play with me and I'm cleaning." A statement ending with a period, naming the problem and validating his feelings. Nick said simply, "Yes." Eleanor asked Nick what he would like to play. He told her, and she said after he took a shower, she would do just that. He quite pleasantly said, "Okay," took his shower, got dressed, and went outside to play with his brothers to wait for his mom. Eleanor made sure she followed through with her promise. Nick felt heard and accepted. The need that was lurking at the root of his behavior was addressed, so the behavior disappeared. Rechanneling energy. When children have revved up to fifth gear and can't bring themselves back down without intervention, it's important to remember that their energy has overpowered them, not that they are being defiant and disobedient. Because you know this child wants to be successful, is battling an obstacle, and his behavior signals his emotional state, you can intervene with help rather than criticism or punishment. Rechanneling the energy tells your child that he needs to do something different with his energy, not that he's bad for having it. In a fit of rage, a child low on impulse control and high on stress can easily turn that energy into hitting or kicking. Objects are thrown, doors are slammed, and parents, siblings, and pets get hurt. Isolating this child in timeout or her room only increases the upset unless you remain with her. But if you are enraged, fuel is added to the fire as she has to react to your energy as well. Staying out of your child's problem and not taking it personally allows you to remain calm and redirect her energy to an appropriate target. Aside from the usual punching bags and pillows, clay, drawing, one family invented beat-up buddies. Each child used an old pair of footy pajamas that they stuffed with pieces of foam rubber. Each was zipped over a stuffed animal or doll to provide a head. There are as many potential outlets for rechanneling as there are needs for it. When you remain calm, you can remove the overwhelmed child to another room to change the environment. Holding, hugging, and simple touches offer a calming energy. Rechanneling into reading, cuddling, or walking allows the child the time to downshift back to neutral, but they need your calm influence. Isolation only increases the problem. Don't patronize. When connective communication sounds phony, children feel demeaned. If your child covers her ears or says, "Stop talking like that," that is your cue to take even the tone of a but out of your words. Get more honest and to the point, or more sophisticated with naming the problem. Very young and pre-verbal children love to hear back exactly what happened. "You felt really angry when you got hit. That pencil got pushed right into your arm. See, there's even a mark. It really hurts." Your empathic description of the experience feels like a warm blanket of validation. But once your child gets savvier, his reaction might be, "Duh, Mom." As children get older, we need to get right to the point. "You're obviously angry with me about something. Instead of hitting your sister, tell me what you're mad about," is better than, "You're feeling really angry." And be careful your tone isn't adding, "But you can't hit your sister." There's never an age when connective communication doesn't work. Don't be afraid to go for the real deal. "After I heard from your teacher what happened today, I wondered if the fight you must have overheard last night between your father and me was upsetting you in school." If that's not the case, you'll likely hear, "What are you talking about?" To which you can reply, "Oh, good, I'm glad that it wasn't." But if it is, you've dug out the root. We can connect with our children's feelings, agendas, and wishes and still not share their opinions or allow behavior we think is wrong. "I can understand why you feel that way about your coach" is not saying, "You're right, your coach is a jerk. You must have been so angry that you couldn't stop yourself from punching your brother" is not condoning the punch. Putting it all together, Once you understand the importance of being a sounding board and are able to use connective communication, you help your child dig into her feelings and get closer to problem solving. When my daughter Molly was in third grade, she had difficulty with a girl assigned to sit next to her on the school bus. Sally was a year older and teased Molly daily. One day, I watched Molly coming up the walk from the bus and knew by the look on her face that it had come to a head. She walked in the door, threw down her backpack, and burst into tears. I carried her to the couch and held her while she cried and cried. "She makes me so mad. I hate her," Molly finally got out. I let her know that I understood, then dug deeper. "I bet you wish you could punch her." It's in there. No need to keep secret your child's darkest wishes or fantasies. They are often the strongest roots. "I wish I could pull her arms off," she screamed. "I bet you do, and her legs too," I said. Then, "I think we need the punching pillow." I brought over our big square pillow used for times like this. She grabbed it from me, threw it on the floor, and began to jump up and down on it, yelling and crying. Molly was used to this process and was able to get her feelings out quickly. "What do you want to happen, Moll?" Once her feelings were out, asking the question got her thinking. It was not my problem to solve, nor was it up to me to tell her what to do about it. She kept jumping, and she yelled, "I want everybody to get mad at her. I want you to get mad at her. I want her mother to get mad at her. I want the bus driver to get mad at her. And I want her teacher to get mad at her. It's not fair. Doesn't she know I have feelings, too?" There it all was, spilled out onto the punching pillow. Instead of telling her that she should ask to have her seat changed, or tell Sally how she felt, or call the bus driver myself, I asked, "What would you like to do about it?" Her tears and anger were subsiding. "I want you to write her a letter," she said with amazing determination. I went to find a pad and pencil to take down her dictated words, but at this point I thought I would burst if I didn't get to the bathroom. I asked her to hold her thought. When I returned, I picked up the pad and pencil and said, "Okay, Ma, what do you want to say to Sally?" Cuddled comfortably on the couch, she muttered from behind a book, "Not now, I'm reading." My heart sank. Once Molly got absorbed in a book, there was no way to coax her back. Frustrated, but plotting to return to it after dinner, I put the pad down and left her alone. At dinner that night, we began as usual by saying something we were grateful for. My husband, my son, and I went. It came to Molly, who usually passed. As casually as commenting on the weather, she said, "I'm grateful I worked out the problem with Sally." She didn't have to send the letter. She just needed to vent her feelings in a safe, supportive environment and know that she was understood. All I needed to do was let her. First, by being a sounding board, then by acknowledging her feelings and fantasies. Molly never mentioned another word about Sally. I can only assume being heard and acknowledged gave her the strength she needed. When we think we know better. Without connection, we miss the opportunity to understand another's point of view or get another side of the story. We naturally make assumptions, see situations from our own perspective, and draw our own conclusions. We think we know best, and children should always listen to us. A story that came up in a private session shows how easily a parent's conclusions can lead to unfair treatment and unnecessary resentment. Pam has two daughters, Abigail, 6, her mother's button pusher, and Ava, 10, her easygoing child. In our session, Pam said, "I can't figure it out, but I'm suddenly having problems with Ava. I don't know what's going on. She's being quite mean to Abigail, putting her down, teasing her, and just not acting like normal." We talked about a few things Pam could try until a story came out that explained it all. Their favorite 12-year-old cousin, Josie, called one evening as the girls were getting ready for bed. Pam called Ava to the phone first and told Abigail that she could talk after Ava was finished. Underestimating Abigail's determination to talk now, Pam let her get on the extension instead of dealing with another meltdown before bed. By the time Abigail got on the phone, Ava and Josie were chattering and laughing. Although all three girls had a great fondness for each other, Ava and Josie, being closer in age, had more in common, and Abigail was always racing to catch up. Abigail picked up the phone, heard their laughter, and joined them in the only way she knew how, by being silly. Nonsense words and noises amused the older girls for about 30 seconds. But then Ava told her sister to stop, Abigail continued, and Ava's patience wore thin. Soon, "Stop it, Abigail," turned to, "Shut up, Abby. Get off the phone right now. You're being stupid." Overhearing only Ava's words and now dealing with Abigail's tears, Pam yelled out to Ava, "Why would you say something like that? You don't have a monopoly on your cousin, you know." All week, Ava had been uncharacteristically taunting and poking fun at Abigail and was beginning to call her names. I told Pam that I thought Ava was justified in her frustration toward her sister. Her side of the story would be that Abigail barged in with little girl silliness to her mature conversation. Of course she would be annoyed and angry. Pam agreed, but still couldn't get over Ava's rudeness. "Be sure you're not asking Ava to compensate for Abby simply because Ava is more compliant," I suggested. "You're setting up sibling resentment that way." Pam realized that's exactly what she'd been doing. Reconnecting. After that, Pam talked to Ava about the phone call. She confessed that she hadn't taken into account how frustrating it must have been for her when her sister suddenly broke in and got silly. Ava told her mother that she did try to get Abby to stop, but she wouldn't. Pam acknowledged Ava's attempts and that she must have reached her limit. Ava's behavior toward her sister returned to normal. Reconnection can happen hours, days, weeks, even months or years later. It's never too late. Don't take it personally. In order to be a sounding board for our children, we need to be able to deflect their words and behavior. Not taking it personally requires understanding that your child's problem is not yours to fix, only to help with. It's not about you. Even words like, "You're a liar," signal that this child is upset. It is your clue that he is off track and out of balance. He needs to get those feelings out in a safe, supportive atmosphere far more than he needs to be told to stop talking like that or be punished for hurting his mother's feelings. Once the feelings are out and emotions are down, the problem can be addressed, as we will explore in Chapter 7. We take it personally, especially when kicking, biting, hitting, and name-calling are involved. Physical aggression is very common for 2- to 5-year-olds. They often don't know how to handle their sudden, intense feelings, so they impulsively express them physically. When we assume that they're being mean or violent, we are taking it personally. It becomes about us, what they're doing to us, what we have to do about it, how they're inconveniencing us, or what we have done to create such monsters. This is where the exhaustion of parenting comes from, our assumptions and the emotions those assumptions generate. We get ourselves so worked up and worry about where this behavior will lead that we can't be present in the moment to help our child solve his problem. When very upset, young children are unable to, first, comprehend what's going on with them, second, put words to that, and third, express those words in a reasonable way. But we want reason. We want their anger to go away, and when we can't make that happen, we feel inadequate. So to avoid that, we put them in timeout or send them to their rooms and feel satisfied that we have done our job. Alternatively, we try to cheer them up and rescue them by giving in, buying them something, or getting out the candy. All options that deny their feelings so we can feel better about ourselves. Handling tough dilemmas. Hard times always call for connective communication. But when feelings are overpowering, talking is often avoided altogether. Fears arise that our children will not be able to cope and that their emotions, if given license, will make things worse. So, in the name of protection, when we don't have an answer, we don't talk about it. Betsy came to me soon after there was a suicide in her family. She understandably had some very strong feelings she was dealing with, and 5-year-old Lily had overheard a good deal of crying and wailing from her mother. Lily knew about the death, but couldn't make sense of what had happened to her mother. She suddenly didn't want her mother to touch her, put her to bed, or have anything to do with her. I suggested that Betsy address Lily's feelings and also explain very plainly what was happening to her, rather than try to protect her from sadness. An answer was impossible. "I was lying down with her one night," Betsy related, "and Lily said, 'I don't want you to put me to bed. I don't like you. I hate your clothes. I don't want your clothes to touch me.' I said to her, 'It sounds like you're feeling upset and frustrated with me because I've been acting differently. I have been upset and haven't been able to be the kind of mommy that I want to be. Before I had a chance to say more, Lily said, "I just want things to go back to normal." I said that I did too and explained that they would in time, but that when people die, things change, and it's hard for a while. Lily asked if I would start taking her and picking her up from school again, and if I would be at home at night more. After I answered yes, she asked me to rub her back and cuddle with her. This was the first time she allowed affection from me in over a week. Things slowly returned to normal for Betsy, but that night was a turning point for Lily. She continued to use her mother for comfort. In The Body Never Lies, The Lingering Effects of Hurtful Parenting, Alice Miller claims that, quote, "Repressed, disassociated emotions can make us ill, but not conscious feelings that we can give expression to," end quote. No matter how traumatic the circumstance, once the roots can be attended and voice can be given to the emotions in a safe and understanding environment, almost anything can be processed, consciously managed, and even healed. Main ideas from Chapter 5. Connection creates direct access to a problem or an obstacle by addressing the root. The gap is the space created between parent and child when the message received by the child is entirely different from the message intended. Children turn parent deaf when they don't like what they hear. Owning your problem means taking responsibility for it and not blaming it on your child. Connective communication acknowledges, validates, and gives release to pent-up feelings that could otherwise fuel misbehavior. Connective communication helps the nonverbal or introverted child by not requiring a response. Children need allies and sounding boards. Empathizing and validating do not condone behavior. Connective communication requires detachment, not taking it personally. Reconnection can happen at any time. It's never too late to go back over a situation. The exhaustion of parenting comes from the emotions generated from automatic and reactive assumptions, from taking it personally. Practice. Become aware of situations where there is a gap between you and your child, an issue you feel unable or uncomfortable to address, a misunderstanding, or something your child doesn't want to talk about. Ask yourself how your child perceives you in that situation. What would he say about you if he were describing the situation to someone? Think what he would like to hear you say, not giving him what he wants, but something validating, connecting. Use connective communication if you can detach and remain neutral. Notice how quickly you want to ask questions and get to a solution. Hold an air of genuine curiosity rather than interrogation.